which is cultural history. Now, that's even more difficult. What is cultural history? Oh, my God. Now, although social history, I think I feel fairly clear about what it is. Cultural history, people keep arguing about what it means. There's no general agreement about what it means. We know it's new. It's newish. It's 30, 40 years old. Well, the idea of cultural history is 30, 40 years old. Because it comes back to the question, what is culture? Oh, well, it's culture, isn't it? Culture is culture. And it's the sort of word that when you look at it carefully, you think, I thought I knew what it meant, but now I'm not so sure. Because, of course, we use culture to say, if you say he has a lot of culture, you mean, oh, well, he's read Victor Hugo and Shakespeare, and he sometimes listens to Mozart, and he knows where Zimbabwe is, you know, the knowledge about the world, and in particular about the artistic elements of the world. Well, that's not really the idea. So let's see what cultural history is. 14 to 18. See if I can find it. Well, I think we're not going to be able to say exactly what it is. All we're going to be able to say is some of the questions which are specially priorities for cultural history, and some of the things that we say what it's not. So it's not easy to define, but certainly one of its priorities is the importance of representation. For example, it's not interested only in the facts, but very specially interested in what the facts meant to people. So, for example, if you wanted to write a history of fidelity in the 20th century in France, that would be very much a cultural history. And as you see in the metro today, you can have, you know, le site web spécialisé dans la fidélité maritale, si vous êtes marié, contactez ici. Even 20 years ago, this was impossible. It was not illegal. There wasn't internet, but even, you know, the equivalent, it was not possible because the attitudes were not... Now, even today, many people think it's a very bad thing, yeah? But it's there is more tolerance, and so that would be a cultural history. What did... Not just what infidelity happened, but what did it mean to people, the history of people's attitudes. So cultural history is close to, it's not the same as, but it's close to a French idea, histoire des mentalités. It's not the same thing, but it's close to. Apart from representation, we also have the question of identity, the importance of identity, regional identity. Let's take the First World War. In 1914, did Scottish people feel Scottish or did they feel British? How did the Indians, who came in very large numbers to fight in France for the British Empire, how did they feel about being Indian and about being British? So your sources can be the same. You can analyse letters, you can analyse diaries, you can analyse monuments, whatever you like, but your questions are a little different. The questions of identity, questions of representation. One of the elements of this, again, the universities are important for history, and one of the elements which was happening to encourage this was the decline, the relative decline of the influence of Marxism. For a series of reasons which have no connection with the history of the First World War, Marxism became less influential. Obviously, 1989, 1992, the collapse of the economic system in Eastern Europe and in Russia, and many people identified this economic system with Marxism, and so the general result as well, you know, well, isn't Marxism all old-fashioned and dead now? Forget it. In general, there has been a number of philosophers and historians who say we don't want any grand narratives anymore. You know, we don't want the grand narratives. And in particular, they were thinking of a grand Marxist narrative, the idea that feudalism moves to capitalism, and capitalism more or less inevitably gets into bigger and bigger crises and either is transformed by revolution or collapses into chaos and barbarism. Now, of course, very often the Marxism which was rejected was the simplest version, the most simplistic version. I quite like Marxism, and I consider people rejected a very simplistic version of it, but that was one of the reasons for the rise of cultural history. Cultural history both changed everybody's history, everybody's books, history books, and also gave some new subjects. So, for example, even the book Conscripts, which was military history, inside this book, Conscripts, which is a book written just a few years ago, there is a lot about how the soldiers felt about being soldiers. Did they feel they were civilians in the army temporarily, or did they feel they had become soldiers? Yeah? So these are questions of cultural history. So really, everywhere, the influence of cultural history was found everywhere. So it wasn't just new history books. It was also new history books. One of the most notable elements is a whole load of new books about representation. The book by Paul Fussell, The Great War and Modern Memory, was one of the most influential, and we'll be looking at a few more in a moment. Paul Fussell looks at how the First World War was presented in novels in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. Yeah. So you see, we have a completely different kind of history. We're not looking at the war. We're looking at how it was presented afterwards. In France, Nicolas Offenstadt, who I met for the first time the day before yesterday, published a book, 1418 aujourd'hui. And he looks at France in the 21st century, in the last 10 years, 15 years, and how it is represented. For example, he collects 20 rock songs of the last 20 years which talk about the First World War, and he analyzes them. He collects bande dessinée, comic books, and analyzes them. Cinema. How is the First World War marked in the cinema? He also studies Les Associations de Mémoire de la Première Guerre. Il y en a beaucoup en France. So we're looking at how do people remember it. And one of the most popular subjects for cultural history today is commemoration. So how is the First World War commemorated is a really big subject today. It's a favorite subject, I'd say. Some people even do their master's dissertation on it. Cultural history. Let's have a look at a few of the books. This is a small number. So it's not an easy book to read, but very, very influential. This was considered to be the book which brought cultural history to the First World War, which is probably a bit of an exaggeration. The Great War of Modern Memory. Paul Fussell, notice it won the National Book Award, the National Book Critics Circle Award, and that's the one I just mentioned to you. But it's quite old book. This is the 25th anniversary edition, so it goes back some time. I'm not sure exactly when the first edition was. And there's 14-18 aujourd'hui, La Grande Guerre dans la France contemporaine. So this is something very interesting. At the same time, some people say, well, that's not history, because you're writing about today. You're writing about what happens today and what are people doing and saying today about the history. European culture. The other aspects of cultural history are different because they actually go back. So this is the arts, entertainment, and propaganda, 1914 to 18. So this is a different one. This is about culture during the war. But then there's many books about later culture about the war. Here's some more books which are considered to be cultural history. This one by Michael Roper, The Secret Battle, Emotional Survival in the Great War. And you can see at the top it says Cultural History of Modern War. Now, cultural history is very in fashion at the moment, so many people put cultural history in place. That's the word you want at the front of your book, yeah. But this one is interesting. Emotional survival. So this is a book, so it's about the war, it's not about afterwards. It's about emotional survival during the war. Now, that's quite a difficult concept, because how do you know if somebody survived or not emotionally? Not so easy, you know. Yeah, it could be in a bad way. The secret battle against secrets. We're going to tell you something you didn't know. The untold story of the secret battle. And in fact, I was interested in this book, so when I was in the library, I had a look at it. And what it is, in fact, is something rather restricted. It's an analysis of letters of soldiers to their mothers. And it analyses how they considered their mother and how important their mother was. So it's an interesting question. I think it's an interesting question. But it's perhaps not as big as the title, yeah, Emotional Survival. Yeah. Some people don't like their mother. Okay. And as I was saying, the most fighting different wars, experience, memory, and the First World War in Britain. Fighting different wars. Of course, people didn't fight different wars. People fought the same war, but then afterwards they had different opinions about it. And so this is one of the difficulties we have, that if you interview old soldiers from any war, some of the soldiers will say, it was terrible. Yeah, the generals were real bastards, and it was a complete waste of time. And another soldier, perhaps in the same battalion, will say, the generals were wonderful with us. Yeah, you finding the facts is not so easy, because it's... and as you know, even today... even today, if you ask about something fairly simple, you know, if I ask 100 women at Crete, how are women treated in the University of Crete? Is there complete equality with men or not? I will get 100 different answers. But these are people who are here. Yeah? So, you know, it's not so easy getting the facts here, fighting different wars. What else do we have here? A war imagined. I can't read the rest of that. Can you read that anymore? No? The First World War and... The First World War and what? The First World War and something else. And English. Oh, maybe it'll be better. Maybe it'll be easier on here. If it comes up here, it might. Nope. Well, that's even worse. Never mind. Never mind. The First World War in English something. Right, now I've... Now, yes, there you go. All right, what else do we have? And finally, as I mentioned, the question of commemoration. So look at this book, Unionists and Great War Commemoration in the North of Ireland between 1914 and 1939. So this is, yeah, what happened in the 1920s and the 1930s in this particular place to commemorate the war. So how can we, what can we understand about the North of Ireland in this period? By looking at how they commemorate. And the same thing, you could do this today, of course there will be many books written about the commemoration today. The commemoration of the centenary of the First World War is very different in Britain, in France, in Germany, in Italy. And so the question, of course, you know that I'm going to ask is, why is it so different? And it's not an easy question, but I think I've probably already said that when you're a historian, the two really interesting questions are, one, why did it happen? And number two, how do we know? How do we know what happened? That's the historiography for you. War Memory and Popular Culture, Essays on Modes of Remembrance. Modes of Remembrance. Now this gets very complicated. Oh, what's a mode of... What, can I'd like two modes of remembrance, please, and £5 of potatoes. It's a difficult concept, yeah? Modes of remembrance and commemoration. What's the difference between remembrance and commemoration? I don't know. Remembrance? Commemoration? It's almost the same thing. I assume that inside they will explain to us. I'm afraid I haven't had time to read this one yet. The politics of war memory and commemoration. So that's more specific. It says, when people decide to commemorate something, there's a political reason. Let's have a look at it. Certainly that's the case. Right at the moment, there is a big fight in Britain, in the British newspapers, about the commemoration. 2 days ago, or maybe last week, one of the Conservative ministers spoke about the pacifists in the First World War and said, oh, they were cranks. City-de-dang? The cranks? How would you say cranks? Oui, mais c'est plutôt des... C'est plus méchant que les originaux, mais c'est pas aussi méchant que les cinglés. But in any case, what's interesting is that then somebody else wrote a big letter to, and there's loads of newspaper articles. Is it acceptable to say, oh, they were cranks? Or is that not acceptable? And then again, somebody else said, oh, the First World War was a terrible waste. And then you get another article, how dare you insult my grandfather? It's taken very emotional, very personal. And that has a meaning, as well, of course. This is an interesting book. This is a book about battlefield tourism. Quite a lot of English people go to France to see the different places. And that has a meaning. And so this is not a book about the First World War. This is a book about the people who, between 1919 and 1939, went to see the places of the First World War and why they did and what that meant. So the strong points of cultural history are definitely those two. There may be more. Huh? One, the concentration on lived experience. What did it mean to people? Not just what happened, that's just a list of facts, but what did it mean to people to live as nurses or as soldiers or as other people? And the criticism which have been made of cultural history by the people who are not so happy, they say, one of the problems is it sometimes ignores important institutions back the state. So for example, you say, oh, right, okay, people understood, the British saw Germany in this way, and the British saw war in this way. But the war did not happen because of the way British people saw the war, saw Germany. It happened for political reasons, good or bad political reasons. And so there's one of the dangers. And the second one is that sometimes it's a criticism, sometimes you can get the impression that there is a uniformity of culture. So, for example, a few historians in France have talked a lot about consentement, that the general situation for the First World War, the French population was consentement. And the difficulty with this is that it can be rather simplistic, of course, because everybody disagrees. This is something I find out a lot living in France, because people say to me, what do English people think about America? What do English people think about Iraq or France? And of course, the answer is, well, they all have different opinions. Well, not all of them, but the people are divided. People are always divided. Thank you very much for listening. I will see you next week at the same time. And remember your dates, the 6th.